Thank you, Alva. Yes, I was about to start by saying that, lest I be head up under the Trades Description Act, that my title seems to promise everything. And it isn't possible even within the time constraints. So I'm going to be talking mainly about constructions of gender in narratives of sanctity. And when I'm talking about gender, I'm talking about particular aspects. Socially constructed relations, sometimes asymmetrical relationships and differences between men and women, and in essence, about power relations. And Ireland sets up the same questions as we've had in other places, new ideas about power and identity. Is Christianity a transforming agent, or was the existing patriarchy of society reinforced by Christianity? I'm, you see, asking questions rather than offering answers at this point. The other thing about the nature of the evidence is its textual construction, or at least the evidence I'm going to be dealing with, the fact that we have evidence by people who were already party pre, being themselves clerics. Now, in terms of evidence, of course, the first and major evidence is the writings of St. Patrick, and already he gives us some information. He talks about people who up to now had cults or idols or abominations are made a people of the Lord and known as children of God. Sons of the Scotti and daughters of chiefs are openly monks and virgins of Christ. He speaks also of a certain noblewoman whom I baptized. A few days later, she had reason to come to us. She told us privately that she had received a message from an angel of God who commanded her to be a virgin of Christ and so draw nearer to him. Thanks be to God, just 6 days after she embraced in the most excellent and eager way that which all virgins of gods follow. He says also they do not do it with their father's consent. On the contrary, they endure harassment and false accusations from their parents, and yet, nevertheless, their numbers increase. Now, it has been said that Patrick shows a special affinity and understanding of the position of women. It seems to me that women would not have converted were there not other social and symbolic examples before them. In other words, going to a male preacher and changing the way of life needs, I think, to be nuanced considerably. And I think we'll have a look in the course of our evidence at what these social and symbolic aids might have been. As against Patrick's alleged understanding, there's also in the Confessio his admission that though he tried to safeguard himself in his dealings, even with the Christian brethren and with virgins of Christ and with religious women, who would spontaneously offer me gifts or throw some of their personal ornaments on the altar. These I repeatedly gave back to them, and they were offended with me, not knowing why I did so. But I did it from the hope of eternity, because of which I aimed at being careful of my integrity in all my dealings. Here, I think, there's an example of profound misunderstanding. I think the Christian women had the belief of their society in reciprocity, that in return for baptism or pastoral care, they would offer something. Patrick here, though in other places, for instance, when he gives gifts to the sons of kings to accompany him, seems tuned into the social norms. Here, I think, we have an example of where the social norms actually do not work. Now, Patrick's evidence, obviously, takes us far and no further. So I want to broaden the perspective by looking at what was written about the conversion period and its leaders in the 7th century. that is the hagiographical works associated with the life of Patrick and the life of Bridget. Because, of course, gender is particularly implicated in early Irish Christianity by the prominence of a female figure, Bridget, whose community indeed claim equivalent status for her. And this indeed is not, by the way of its treatment in other contexts, invalid. So we're looking at the lives of the 7th century lives of Patrick, and Elizabeth's paper this morning has prepared the way in her discussion of Tyrconn. We'll be looking at Murucu and Tyrconn, and at the Brigidine hagiography, at the life by Cogitosis, and also the so-called Vita Prima, which I take to be composed of 7th century material, a reworking of, I will say, more than one, without being more specific, 7th century text. Now, it seems to me that a way of dealing with these lives is to take an overview of all of them together. And when I did so, it seemed to me that Murucu and Cogitosis are closely related in perspective, as are Tyrconn and Vita Prima. Now, as the second of your handout extracts show, in fact, Murucu specifically mentions his indebtedness to Cogitosis. He uses, there should be a two-page handout for everybody. Murucu mentions taking his little skiff on the great sea of writing, which nobody had done before, except for the efforts of his father in Christ, presumably Cogitosis. It seems to me when you look at these lives, grouping Murucu and Cogitosis together, Tyrconn and the Vita Prima, we see the former, that's Murucu and Cogitosis, as centralizing, tightly controlled representations of how male and female subjects act in ecclesiastical roles. On the other hand, Tyrconn and the Vita Prima seem more discursive and diffused. They're focused on a lower hierarchical level. The upper echelons are prominent in Murucu Cogitosis. The Tyrconn and Vita Prima, their narrative for society is more drilled down, as common parlance has it today. One is characterized, that's Murucu and Cogitosis, by exclusion, and Tyrconn and Vita Prima by inclusion. Now, how are these different outlooks and perspectives demonstrated? I have put on the handout, and some of the other things I will hope to return to, various extracts from the conversion narrative of Tyrconn, indeed, which you have already seen this morning. Now, number 20, what is Tyrconn 29? I have picked because in its account of the Franks of Patrick, it seems to me that perhaps we have there an inkling of the social motivation that religious women might have had for conversion. Because the Franks of Patrick, who may have been his assistants in conversion, are brothers with one sister whose name is Nitria. It's slight, clearly, but nevertheless, it may be a token of what there is. As for the pattern in the other extracts, the conversion pattern, it seems to be that sisters convert with brothers. For instance, in 24 and in the other one, which is 34. And the Blessed Maiden came to him in pilgrimage, named Mahona, a sister of Benignus, the successor of Patrick, and took the veil from Patrick and Rodanus. Now, what took the veil meant in these circumstances is problematic. Did it mean that they lived in an organized female community? Did it mean taking a vow of virginity? All of that is left open and unsaid. In the next one, the one in the wood of Toker, he went out to the plain of Toker, and built a church there. And in that place, a bishop of the race of Corcuhevna came to him from Kel-Tok in the territory of Tevenriga in Kerra in the west, a bishop with one sister, both being persons in religion attached to Patrick. This begs the question, of course, whether it is the conversion of families and the donating of family land to the church that brings the females into religion as well as their brother. And this may mean simply baptism without entering into religious roles, but sometimes it can mean entering into religious roles. One of the stories, which is one of the very famous stories, the conversion of the two daughters of Lyra, nevertheless, is an example, perhaps, of limits in this process, because this is I cannot see it right now. Yes, it's what begins with number 15 there. And they were baptized, and a white garment. This is the confusion then, the use of the white garment or something like a veil in the baptism ceremony itself, perhaps easily confused with the assumption of the veil mentioned in religious consecration. But these two daughters of the king, having been baptized, they ask to see the face of Christ, and they die and are buried. Now, obviously, the story is contrived, but it's contrived, I think, because somehow there is no other way of ending it, that society could accommodate the dead religious princesses, but that it was much more difficult, perhaps, to accommodate their afterlife as Christians because of their royal status. Now, in terms then of how all of this might have functioned, the brothers and sisters in religion, the vagueness about their status, whether as baptized Christians or whether as professed religious, I draw your attention to another patrician source, the so-called Book of the Angel, that's the last one on that page, which talks about, in this city of Armagh, that's Patrick's church, Christians of both sexes are seen to live together in religion from the coming of faith to the present day, almost inseparably. And to this aforesaid city also adhere three orders, virgins and penitents, and those serving the church in legitimate matrimony. And these three orders are allowed to hear the word of preaching in the church of the northern district on Sundays always. In the southern basilica, however, bishops and priests and anchorites and other religious offer pleasing praises. So distinction and difference here are on secular religious lines rather than on gender lines. Now, Tirakan then gives us this fairly nuanced picture of males and females both involved in the Christian conversion process. Whereas Muruku, and you'll find he's not even on your handout, because he dwells completely on male hegemony. Patrick, the male leader, deals with other male power sources, the druids, kings. Women have just barely walk-on parts. For instance, the Queen of Tara, it tells the king he'd better convert if he wants to live, and then disappears. So exclusion seems to be the outlook from the top, from the hierarchical point of view. Women are not part of the discourse. Women are subjects rather than agents. And the hagiography of Tirakan then contrasts completely with Muruku's views on the matter. And I think the same is true of the Brigid sources. Cogitosa's life of Brigid begins, and this is over your page, by strong statements about Kildare itself, Brigid's church. It's the head of almost all the Irish churches, with supremacy over all the monasteries of the Irish, and so on. And talks about Brigid: by her wise administration, she made provision in every detail for the souls of her people, according to the rule, as she vigilantly watched over the churches attached to her in many provinces. And as she reflected that she could not be without a high priest to consecrate churches and confer ecclesiastical orders in them, she sent for Conleth. So in fact, she's almost as soon as she is introduced, she is sending for a bishop in order that she would be properly equipped to deal with religious matters to the fullest degree. So that, and this is the end of the sentence, that he might govern the church with her, in the office of bishop, and that her churches might lack nothing as regards priestly order. In the same way, at the end, you have an account of the Church of Kildare, which is very famous and hardly needs to be rehearsed again, with these divisions in the church, walls in the east part of the church, where there are two doors, one at each end, and through the door situated on the right, the archbishop enters and those appointed to the sacred mysteries. The other door, the abbess and her nuns. And then in the body of the church, again, a wall through which males enter on one side and females, nuns and congregation and faithful women on the other. And so, and this is worth thinking about in association with the Book of the Angel, which I have just mentioned. And so in one vast basilica, a large congregation of people of varying status, rank, sex, and local origin, with partitions placed between them, prays to the omnipotent master, differing in status, but one in spirit. Well, that is true, but they're divided very strictly on gender differences, as well as on ecclesiastical hierarchical differences there. Now, the contrast between the beginning and end of cogitosis and the body of the life is quite spectacular. Again, I haven't actually put any extracts from it, because there is almost no extract that is apt to display Brigid as a religious leader. We see her in her what are essentially gender-oriented roles, providing food, healing, doing nature miracles. The other thing that is striking in the body of the cogitosis text is that we almost never see Brigid in an ecclesiastical context. She is either in a country setting, in transit in her chariot. So there's a disjunction. It's almost like beginning and end are corralling this central part, which is very unecclesiastical and shows Bridget in roles which are, if you will put it this way, harmless, having ducks fly to her, tame foxes, hungry dogs, all of that sort of thing. So it seemed first to me, as to many other people, that all of that exclusion of religious roles was actually reflecting the underlying goddess theme in the Bridget dossier. But as we shall see, I now have changed my mind. The Vita Prima, turning to it, is as inclusive as Cogitosa's life is excluding. First of all, we have Bridget's consecration. But what is most striking in the extracts, and they are only examples in the extracts that I have put out, is the liturgical role in which Bridget is presented. Number five, the second paragraph of the Vita Prima, for instance, shows her in the role of exorcist. Now the material itself looks like it's based on the Vita Martini, but the fact that the choice is made to include it is interesting. So a virgin with a demon in her, which resided in her because of laziness, is banished by Bridget. Now in number 36, there's an equally striking liturgical example. St. Bridget goes to a church in the Tetva area for the Easter season. However, the superioress of the church said to her nuns on the day of the Lord's Supper, "Which of you is going to do the washing of the feet today for the old people and are sick?" So in other words, the washing of the feet, which is a male clerical role, is actually taken over by the nuns, and in this case, by Bridget. In number 40, a countryman comes to her to bless his new house, and she demands that he be baptized. Patrick intervenes here and says, "Perhaps it's better that you don't travel without a priest. Your charioteer is always to be a priest." Contrasting, of course, with the Cogitosis's early salvo that she needed a bishop and got a bishop straight away. So it seems to me that Cogitosis's innocuous presentation of Bridget's ecclesiastical primacy is to be contrasted with a very active liturgical role in the Vita Prima. So is there suppression of this aspect in the interest, again, of the patriarchal attitude which Cogitosis shows? So we have, I think, two sides of the coin, both in the patrician lives and in the Bridget lives. How's the time?
Say just a few more.
Yeah. The one inclusive, the other exclusive of anything that threatens male hierarchy. On the other hand, the last page shows that gender roles were nevertheless not immutable. It takes us to an 8th century text, the life of Éadh of Kel-Awr, which is near Uisnech, the site of Bridget's veiling. Now, the territory in question in this life is territory which, admittedly, later sources, but generally thought not to be unacceptable, this territory, which was conquered by the Enail from the Leinster men in perhaps the 6th century. So the life of Éadh is based centered on this area around Ishnuk, where his chief church is. But what is significant is the extent to which in his life he is shown in context normally associated with a female saint, and particularly with a saint such as Bridget. For instance, in number 12, he goes to a virgin's house and he makes water out of wine. These are the next one where, just as Bridget did, he blessed an erring virgin and took away her pregnancy. In another, he heals Bridget's headache. In number 33, another miracle of the Bridget dossier, where a precious brooch was stolen from a woman in the hope that it would put her into the thief's power, and Bridget comes to the rescue. So in other words, Aedd is given, is transferred the role of Bridget. His cult, he is an Enail saint, is obviously intended as a replacement cult for Bridget. And yet, the cult takes on the lineaments of Bridget's cult so that he is presented in contexts and situations generally associated with female sanctity. So the conclusion I think one must draw is that power overrides gender when it comes to Irish ecclesiastical life. Thank you.